From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a small town in Pennsylvania called Mahanoy City. It's not much of a city, about 3,000 people, and for students in high school there, there weren't always a whole lot of social options. That's why for Brandy Levy, trying out for the varsity cheerleading squad was a big deal. Unfortunately for Brandy, she did not make the squad. When she found out in the spring of 2017, she posted a furious and profane Snapchat message. She made this post on her own time, not on school grounds. As you might know, Snapchat is built on the idea of messages self-deleting. But as so often happens, this particular post got saved and sent to school officials. They decided to suspend Brandy from even JV cheerleading for the next year on the grounds that she had signed what was subject to a school district policy prohibiting speech like this on social media. Her parents filed suit on her behalf in federal court. They argued that the district had unconstitutionally punished her for speech made completely outside of the school and speech that did not pose a risk of disruption. She's venting. She's a kid, they said. How important is this case? It might seem like a social media distraction, but keen observers like the legal analysts at Slate have argued that the future of student free speech comes down to a foul-mouthed cheerleader. They argue, quote, "This case is an all-the-marbles moment for civic education in America. You cannot teach respect for constitutional rights to young people who experience the Constitution only as a meaningless abstraction in a textbook," end quote. In particular, I appreciated how the Slate team saw this incident with Brandy. "We all have bad moments," they wrote. And they elaborated, quote, "Brandy said on Snapchat some version of what stressed-out students have been saying on the back of the school bus since the invention of the school bus. Blank school, blank softball, blank cheer, blank everything." The post was shared on a Saturday afternoon during a trip to the local convenience store. It disappeared from Snapchat by Sunday afternoon and caused no disturbance at school whatsoever, except to irritate the cheerleading coach who banned Levy from the squad for a year. She filed suit, and in June 2020, a federal appeals court ruled that school authorities violated the First Amendment by disciplining her for the off-campus speech. And now, the Mahanoy District is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn that ruling, end quote. This hour, we examine this, and frankly, other cases that go to the heart of free expression, privacy, individual rights, and perhaps individual liabilities. Scott Maloof is a social media attorney who is back with us to take a look at this and a lot more. Hi, Scott. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for having me back.
At the core of this conversation today is the issue of how we communicate and where we communicate. Everybody's probably heard the phrase by now, the internet is forever. But I kind of want to go beyond that a bit. Recently on his podcast, Chris Hayes was talking to John McWhorter about where we communicate. And by where, I mean, you know, do we communicate in private settings, in flitting fashion that vanishes the moment we communicate it? Or do we communicate in public or otherwise recorded fashion? I mean, everybody's made crass remarks they would not be proud of. I have. I mean, if those remarks were publicly shared, everything you've ever said, there would be something that you would not like to be public. Everybody's got tough moments, outbursts, complaining about a boss or a colleague or a friend or an ex or politics or social issues. But the question is, like, what if the vast majority of where we communicate had changed? What if in only a few short years we had gone from being a society that communicates mostly in private to a society that communicates mostly in public? Well, Chris Hayes argues that is exactly what has unfolded, and we are just not appreciating the ramifications enough. Let's listen.
I also wonder how much of all of this is just like, in quantifiable statistical terms, the sheer amount of speech in every direction has expanded by a mind-boggling exponential amount.
Definitely.
It's just the case that we used to have most of our speech, 99%. I mean, I would say 10 years ago, 99% of all speech to maybe 99.99999999999% of all speech for all people in American society was effectively private.
Exactly.
And now, like, half of it's public.
Oh,
and so it seems to me like the excess is run in both directions, right? Both the kind of, like, Twitter castigating you're talking about and this kind of, like, you know, this, what I will admit, some of these sort of mobbish circling of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then also people's saying awful things, that all of this is like, it's almost like a statistical inevitability, right? Like, we mm-hmm. just like start massively expanding the amount of speech we actually put out into the public.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly we're going to be bumping into these speech problems all the time.
That's Chris Hayes with John McWhorter on his recent podcast. Scott Maloof, what do you think?
Yeah, I think he's got a good point there, in the sense of, it kind of sneaks up on us how much we become reliant on these technologies and written communication, where before we would have had that. The other day my wife was at Chipotle and they were only taking digital orders. And so you had to put your order in through your phone. You literally could not walk up and say, hey, here's what I want. And it was to control the rush of people. And I think that's become the norm, and it's something, they themselves, Chipotle, didn't really think about, well, what if somebody doesn't have a phone, or what if it's somebody who's not that conversant with how they do that? So he's got a really good point that these technologies have snuck up on us, especially because of the pandemic, and they're making us ask questions that before would not have existed or wouldn't have occurred, because our activities, our behaviors were fleeting and there was no electronic record.
I mean, nothing disappears into the ether anymore. I mean, except for just conversational speech in private settings. But even then, who knows if someone's rolling on a cell phone camera? I mean, there's just so much that it doesn't go away. And I think, Scott, for example, of a woman who, I think the plausible explanation is that she posted on Twitter, she was trying to make a commentary against racism. And she posted what she thought was an obvious mockery of a racist joke to kind of point out the absurdity of it. But mm-hmm. people discovered it later, not realizing any of the context. And they just read it as a racist joke itself. And all of a sudden, she's out of a job. So it's like, if you're making a commentary in a flippant way to a friend or a group of people, sitting around a campfire, they'll know the context, and then it doesn't much matter anyway, because that speech will disappear into the atmosphere. If you do it on Twitter or Facebook or somewhere else, even Snapchat, and people who don't know the context grab this thing, it could destroy your life years later. I mean, that stuff's happening, and it's really wild. And I think the point that Hayes is making is one that I take very well, which is that the speed of change has outpaced our grappling with the consequences for that change, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it does. And I think the point you started with is so important, is that all of these social tools, whether it's Twitter or Facebook, you have to understand they're very decontextualizing, meaning you and I, Evan, we're having a discussion here. Everybody who's listening has made, we have a shared understanding of what's going on, and we're going to debate issues. Whereas if, somebody 3 years later grabs a 30-second snippet of this discussion and says, look what Evan and Scott were saying 3 years ago, all of a sudden, all of the things that the audience together right now we're all participating in would all fall away, and people would do that. And then you may have somebody who further just pulls out a couple of sentences and says, look what they said, or look what was not said. So, yeah, you have to understand that social is incredibly decontextualizing, yet a lot of people turn to it for their first take, for getting news, for debating issues. A lot of folks in the media will look at, some people on Twitter are saying, instead of saying, I got to take a step back and understand, what about all the other voices or the other understandings that aren't on these particular platforms?
Yeah, and that's why, to that point, even something that seems obvious 3 years later without context can look very, very different. That's an argument in favor of just setting any app that you can to auto-delete old posts. Just sort of protecting yourself from out-of-context stuff. And I don't do it myself. Everything I've got has so far been there in perpetuity. So I'm sure someone will find something objectionable. But no, I just find I find that really, really tough, because often, Scott, I find that we're not very generous with people in terms of being willing to see sort of context or understanding. But then there's the questions like Mahanoy, where, this idea that what someone says when they're venting could cost them a school slot for a year. It could lead to academic sanction. You know, what Brandy Levy would have said to her friends, as Slate wrote on the back of the bus, it would have been totally normal. You didn't make the team. Well, you know, screw this, screw that. Sorry, you know, to sort of be, to use that sort of language, but I mean, she used much worse. And she was doing with what a lot of people have done. So how do you see the district's response to this one, Scott?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I fall in the camp of, you know, it's very easy to punish people for speech, but we should always stop and take a breath and say, is it the right thing to do? You know, as you said, had this been done in person, maybe right before, you know, practice or right after, let's say right after when the announcement had been made as to who got into varsity, you know, I think more of us would have, a coach's reaction would have been to talk to her individually and say, hey, here's something, as opposed to just the one-year ban that came up. So, I mean, first and foremost, I think a lot of the times we see reactions, whether it's somebody should be fired or a student should be punished, are more extreme because of the recording and the sharing of the message and allowing other people to chime in. So I think that's one danger. And second, I think it's really difficult for us to want to empower schools to give them this power to regulate off-campus behavior, because so much of this behavior is online. I mean, if we look at students now, you know, even fifth graders, fourth graders have cell phones. They have chats that are going on. They're communicating while they're playing games. They're, you know, messaging each other in Facebook, even if parents maybe have some oversight over those messages. And so, you know, for the schools, should they now be expected to regulate all this off-campus behavior? It's yet another mission, and maybe it's one that they don't want to undertake, because I know, you know, as an attorney, I'm always worried about, is somebody going to try and game the system? You know, you've seen those stories where there was a parent, another cheerleading parent, who was putting up fake information about a student who was her daughter's opponent on the squad, who she saw as a rival, and wanted that other young woman kicked off. And you can imagine, if the administrative power of the school is there, you know, the school's not a forensic expert. They're not going to be able to parse out and say, well, where did that information come from? And should they even be in that game? I think it's a very chilling idea that the school would reach back into the home and say to the parents or siblings, well, what have you been posting? And I think a lot of schools would probably say, we don't want to be in that business. We want to be in the business of education. We want to be in the business of community building.
Yeah, I mean, most of the time, efforts to chill speech backfire anyway on those who are trying to do the chilling. But there are often real consequences for individuals, whether it's lost job, the student in this case losing a spot on even a JV cheer squad, or academic sanction. Students have lost admissions to colleges when it comes out what they said on Snapchat 5 years ago. And so let me try to take the side of the school district here and make a case, and I want to hear what you think about this case. Could the district say, look, Evan and Scott, you can talk about how much the world has changed. You can talk about how students have always sat on the back of the bus and vented about a teacher or the principal or a coach or whatever. But that is fundamentally different from posting it on a social platform. That is not sitting in private. That is the modern version of quick publishing your own newspaper. And it is not liable for me to say over a backyard fire tonight, did you know that Scott Maloof kidnaps and tortures kittens? I mean, he's a terrible guy. You should. Scott Maloof does that to all kittens. It's terrible. No one should hire Scott Maloof on account of what he does to kittens. I could say that to the neighbor over the fire, and that would go nowhere. But if I posted that on social, that could damage you, because that could spread, and that is fundamentally different. Also, I think Scott likes kittens. Just one point there.
Well, Evan, you've proved our point about decontextualizing. I can hear 10 people now making you.
Oh, yeah, that's a great point. They're gonna take this. Yeah, they're gonna edit this one right out. When you run for office, Scott Maloof, they're gonna take this right out of there, and you're going nowhere.
Heaven forfend.
but could an employer or a school district say it is not the same? You can talk about venting all you want, but when you do it on the modern platforms, that's like publishing a newspaper instantly. And we're going to respond in kind. We're not going to treat this like you venting on the back of the bus, because it's not that.
Well, I think in some ways the very capable lawyers for the school district were arguing, look, the geography that the family, the cheerleaders, lawyers are bringing in here really is not relevant, because the internet is everywhere, because the impact is everywhere. And so the argument for the school district is, it doesn't matter that the post by Ms. Levy was made at a convenience store on a Saturday. The impact was felt in the school. You know, it reaches into the school. I think it was Justice Kagan who said, you know, what if the boys were making a list, you know, ranking some of the girls in school? You know, would that impact not very much be felt in the school, because even if the boys were using their own devices and it was out of school? So that would be their focus, and they'd say, hey, we're the ones who have to deal with this fallout. Now, the flip side that comes back to that is, one, that creates a very slippery slope, because once you start regulating behavior that's left the schoolhouse gates, you know, everything falls into that ambit, you know. And two, the standard becomes very difficult to understand what's forbidden and what's not forbidden. You know, here, for example, you know, Ms. Levy wasn't bullying anyone. She wasn't picking on anyone. She was expressing her generalized displeasure, you know. And that seems like it's a, although using vulgarity, it's something that she should be protected. If she said, I think cheer is a terrible sport and I never liked cheer, you know, that's protected expression. And we would say that's okay. So I think the real answer, you know, to me, or the persuasive argument comes in that it's too easy for people to regulate speech using kind of those administrative powers of schools. And we could see 5 years from now a lot of schools being called upon to do this, because people generally don't like the message as opposed to, you know, focusing on the impact. I mean, it takes a strong stomach for a regulator to stand up and say, I know you don't like this message, but I have to let it through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you agree with Slate's characterizing this as the future of student free speech comes down to a foul-mouthed cheerleader?
Well, no. That's a little much. Well, also because a lot of the cases, if you think about it, a lot of the cases, really, it's the circuit courts. And those courts are creating a lot of the law here, because so few of these kinds of cases are going to go to the Supreme Court. And so, you know, you have to say, what's the Second Circuit going to do? You know, that's our court here in New York. And what kind of cases are coming before them? And the same thing with the district courts. I mean, probably not a lot of families are really going to put the resources and time and stress to bringing a federal case as well. So you really have to say, this is kind of going to come back to training. It's going to come back to the day in and day out running of a district and what people want to do. I'm sure even people who run districts would say, you know, I really don't want to devote a lot of time and resources to taking cases up to the Supreme Court or the highest court in the state, you know, because that keeps us from doing other things.
Yeah, And on the, like, sort of the debate about whether a Snapchat post or a tweet or a Facebook post is closer to the private vent on the back of a school bus or in a break room at work to one other colleague, or is it closer to the publication of a newspaper? I mean, I think the answer is, I mean, I think it is absolutely a hybrid. I mean, you know, it's not... It is absolutely a vent. I mean, people are venting on social media. People are saying crass things or vulgar things or demeaning things about other people in power, sometimes bosses. And that's not the same as publishing a newspaper. It just has more of the permanence. And I think that's what we're still grappling with, is how much permanence there is and how much damage that can do. But I also think, Scott Maloof, do you think the culture is changing? And here I want to shift away, not just from a school district, even though that case is relevant, but I'm talking about workplaces. I think, and maybe I'm naive, I think the culture is changing in that I think the idea that a boss or an executive is going to really put the work hammer down on somebody because they complained in a Facebook post, I think the power dynamic is switching towards workers a little bit to say, hey, don't be so heavy-handed. Because there are consequences, too, when speech gets chilled reputationally to an organization, a company, et cetera. And so much of the chilling of speech just comes from, you know, frankly, you know, big egoed bosses who don't like to be criticized. And I think that they can do that, but I think there eventually becomes a price the more they crack down on that speech. Or maybe I'm being naive. Am I being naive that the culture is changing?
No, I think you're not being naive. I think we're seeing a lot of movements in the culture. You know, we're seeing a coarsening probably of you know, people are more likely to use vulgarity, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, on social media, in blogs, things like that. I actually keep track of lawyer use of vulgarity, you know, so when I do presentations, I'm like, check this out and see what other lawyers are saying. And, you know, and I feel like I've noticed a rise in that, where, say, 10 years ago, a lawyer who's blogging or posting on social would not have used that kind of language. Two, you know, I think we also have to remember we're seeing more external expressions by workers, you know, whether it's gig work or work on the side. You know, somebody may have, you know, a job at an institution, but they're an artist on the side. And so there can be created a tension there, because the person may say, hey, my art is totally separate from work, but other workers may dislike that art, or other individuals may want to communicate, and this has happened in the past, hey, this is what your employee is saying. Is this a value the place, workplace stands for? And finally, yes, I think we all see that there is a value to whistleblowing, and there's a value to, you know, one of the changes we've seen is recordings of interactions with law enforcement. And absent the recordings that have been made over the last 5-10 years, I don't think we would see the shifts in attitude of how police are performing stops and what activities are being taken. And it's because of the recording, because of these small devices that are available. And so it removes some of the subjectivity, and it says, here's the recording. You take a look at it, and you make your own judgment. So there's a lot of things that are moving, and they're, all of these small changes are synergistic, kind of as what you alluded to at the top. They all come together, right? You drive down a street, and you may wonder, how many of these doorbells are Ring doorbells and are recording, you know, walking up on the porch, or am I driving by, and what's happening with that data, just as an example.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get sort of in that direction a little bit more in our second half hour. I will also just mention, as Scott refers to, a kind of acceptance of coarser language, even in legalistic terms, but also just sort of in the general culture. You heard the clip that we played from Chris Hayes' podcast with John McWhorter. John McWhorter is a linguist, and his forthcoming new book is called 9 Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Forever. And it is all about what gives profanity its power. So if you want an interesting read of where John McWhorter, one of the leading linguists of the time, thinks profanity is going, what I found surprising about that is he thinks that we're not far away from the F word from being viewed more like the word damn now, which, you know, I don't say often, but sometimes it comes out, and it, you know, Rob doesn't bleep it for 10 seconds if I say it. He gives me a look. Like, did you really need to? But John McWhorter thinks, Scott Maloof, that we're not that far away from the F word being there. That would shock me. I still feel like the F word has a shocking bluntness that others don't, but I'm not a linguist.
No, I think you're right. I am recalling a presentation years ago where, you know, a number of really seasoned attorneys were on a panel, and one had been describing a case in which she said, oh, my client was, you know, someone was a contractor, you know, it's a really hard nails kind of world. And she, you know, she used the F-bomb in the panel. And everybody was like, okay, you know, it was your example. But then this person went on and did it many, many more times. And you could feel just a shift in the room where people felt, well, wait a minute, now you're being gratuitous. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it really puts the period on the issue that we're talking about, the context where we started, and how sometimes it's there to shock, but eventually that shock value wears off, and now does it become gratuitous? And also, what's the line of offense? I mean, you know, personally, if I were this person's boss, I might say, wait a minute, you know, you took an opportunity that was great, you told a good story, but then you went too far. Mm-hmm. And if I then say discipline the person, you know, should that person come back and report that, you know, would they whistleblow? These are, I think McWhorter's really right that there's a lot of fluidity to the standards, and it's contextual. Somebody in their 20s might be very different than somebody in their 60s, or someone in leadership may have a different standard than somebody who's a frontline employee.
But you know what's going to happen, Scott? This is what's so interesting about this. This is what's going to, something like this will happen. We will see a case in which, boy, I'm thinking about someone like my dad. So my father, I've heard probably use a curse word twice, like ever. And he always told me he thought that profanity, his phrase was, profanity is a verbal crutch. And, you know, use it if you can't express yourself effectively. Well, I mean, I haven't always followed my father's claims, even though if I dropped an F-bomb now, Rob Braden would definitely hit the dump button, because that's not allowed. But once in a while, you know, in private moments, it flies a little bit more freely, and I'm sure my dad wouldn't be happy about that. That's very different than what you're describing, which is using certain coarser language in certain settings. And what I think is going to happen, somebody is going to sue saying that some presentation got taken down or blocked or they got fired because they used profanity, and that's just free expression, that you can't fire me for using an F-bomb. How much power would a case like that have, Scott?
You know, in the generalized employment context, no employment contract, no union contract, no First Amendment applying, that isn't going to be a very strong claim. You know, just because for the most part here in New York, most employees are at-will employers, as long as they're not using a discriminatory reason, can fire you for anything or no reason at all. But let me give you an example that may be helpful. So Microsoft PowerPoint presentation will listen as you speak and tell you what's wrong. You're speaking too fast. Your enunciation isn't very clear. But it also listens for curse words, and it listens for, you know, other inappropriate words. And so that is something where you could see that kind of tool being applied very broadly at workplaces, at schools, and then people bring in a claim of that and saying, well, now, wait a minute, you've set this standard, and this does not only violate my expectations, but it violates maybe the First Amendment, or, you know, people may say, I do see this as kind of a whistleblower thing. By the way, for folks out there who need some fun, open PowerPoint and use some naughty language with it and see how quickly it flags you. It's actually kind of a funny enterprise to do, especially when you're trying to see what its boundaries are.
Wow. And to close the loop on where we started this conversation and what we're watching for with the U.S. Supreme Court, if you're just joining us, we're not talking about the abortion case. That'll be a separate discussion on this program soon, I'm sure, because news came today that the United States Supreme Court is going to take up a case involving abortion, and we'll see where that goes. Now, we're talking about a U.S. Supreme Court case involving free speech and a student in a small Pennsylvania town. And Slate concluded this, Scott. They said, skeptics may look at this case and see the student's punishment, being removed from a club activity for 1 year, as a proverbial wrist slap, certainly not worthy of the U.S. Supreme Court's attention. But don't be fooled. You cannot be a little bit pregnant, and you cannot be a little bit constitutionally unprotected either. Once a category of speech loses its constitutional protection, that means any amount of punishment, even expulsion, is impervious to legal challenge. The fact that Levy lost only a discretionary privilege means nothing as a matter of constitutional law. Nobody has a right to a driver's license either, but you can't lose your license for cursing about the DMV on Snapchat, end quote. Do you agree with that conclusion?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, that once we put speech in an unprotected category, the discussion about punishment, about the term of punishment, about, you know, how we should react to it, that falls away. And I thought that was a really excellent point in that article by the attorney there. You know, and we often hear the misnomer, you know, You can't scream fire in a crowded theater, which is a trope that's really a mistake in First Amendment law. It's, you know, because that was later disavowed by the Supreme Court, you know. And so, but people say that, and then they go, so this chunk of speech is unprotected because it's like screaming fire, and so therefore whatever result I want should happen. So I think it really proves the point that once you take things out of protection, you also lose that secondary punishment and breadth discussion. And you saw that at the Supreme Court, where I think it was Justice Kavanaugh who said, you know, Michael Jordan got cut from his high school team, and he mentioned that in his Hall of Fame acceptance. And so, you know, isn't a year punishment kind of extreme for something that was such a minor statement? I mean, for example, people may not know, Snapchat disappears after 24 hours. So it wasn't as if the student had spray-painted something across the street from the school. It wasn't as if the student was out protesting using this vulgar language. It was fleeting and disappeared quickly. And again, goes back to, but for somebody capturing a screen cap of that, it would have disappeared. So, I mean, that punishment discussion is really, really valuable because You know, even if something is distasteful, we always have to ask ourselves. This came up with the Facebook Oversight Board, where President Trump had been banned from Instagram and Facebook, former President Trump. And the Oversight Board said, you can't just issue a permanent ban. You have to revisit his banning in 6 months and you know, flesh this out. Exactly how did this violate, you know, the rules, and what is the appropriate punishment for that? You can't just say violation and you're gone.
Do you think Trump has a pretty good complaint there on the various platforms where he's saying, you can't keep me off here forever?
That's a tough one because of the fact that we're in really new territory with the Oversight Board from Facebook. You know, I think if you look at his activities over such a long period of time, he was flouting the rules. And so you might say his activities on the 6th of January were just the straw that broke the camel's back. And so it's not like a good faith person who says, oh, gee, you know, one strike. I mean, for him, it's probably something where his detractors would point to and say, that's the 58th strike, you know, on multiple platforms. And, you know, the position, the power of the office, one would expect you to wield it very gently and in the name of all folks, not just in the name of your political ends.
Yeah. I guess the question is then, does he have a right to at least get a hearing every 6 months? Does he have a right to sort of try to press his case here? He does, yeah.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, this is going to be an ongoing debate back and forth, you know. And again, as these platforms become more central to people's lives, you know, and not just these, but some of the other tools out there. So if you have a website and it's being protected from spam or from various attacks by some of those service providers, you know, in the past, they have just kicked people off and said, we're not going to provide it. But we wouldn't do that with electricity. We wouldn't do that with water. We wouldn't do that with medical care. And so maybe are we going to a different space where we say, okay, some of these things are like infrastructure. And do we kind of have a renewing discussion about yes, keep or no keep people, but also knowing they're private entities. And some businesses would say, we're just not going to provide services to certain groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talking to Scott Maloof as we get ready for only break here. I saw a video of former President Trump at Mar-a-Lago. He was telling a crowd that he and his people are going to be watching very closely as new counts of ballots come in from a number of states. And I went, this video must be from November. No, it was from last week. So, I mean, if he was back on Twitter and Facebook, that's what we'd be seeing. You know, just still want to talk about.
And that did come up. I mean, some of the dissenters in the Facebook, if I remember correctly, opinion said, you know, there's an ongoing harm here. Here's somebody whose posts can be seen as violating some other folks' right, like the right to cast a ballot. And so, you know, an argument against is to say, if we let you back on, you're going to do things that maybe are not an immediate harm, but are a bigger picture harm, invalidating people's confidence in ballots when you don't have any evidence, or, you know, making people question the validity of various scientific ideas.
Talking to Scott Maloof, a social media attorney. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a case that you might have seen, a case that Apple hired and fired someone pretty quickly after there was outrage within the company about this person's past forms of speech, actually a book he wrote. And we're also going to talk about some other technological issues that are top of mind as we think about our changing society, understanding speech, free expression, privacy, and more with Scott Maloof here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, the Police Accountability Board has asked for a budget of $5 million to hire more than 50 personnel. And Mayor Lovely Warren's proposed budget includes the $5 million. We'll talk with members of the Police Accountability Board and their executive director about their proposed budget and how the money would be used in this community. PAB under the microscope with us on Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Apple hired and then fired Antonio Garcia Martinez, who had built a career in tech. He had worked in Facebook, was pretty high up. And he wrote a book about kind of a memoir of his life in tech that, you know, some critics thought was junk. Others said it was excellent and compared it to Michael Lewis's Liar's Poker, a memoir of the financial world from the 1980s. So anyway, Apple hires him. And then some of the employees, some of his new colleagues, go back and read his book. His book was called Chaos Monkeys. And they didn't like some of what they found, and they said that, you know, Apple shouldn't have hired him, and Apple responded and said, okay, he's out. Scott, what are the issues that stand out to you as you look at this story?
Yeah. I mean, I think the two big challenges are, one, you know, how do employers navigate this? And this, Evan, is an issue that's come up writ small as well, which is when I have an employee maybe who has past posts or past political positions that other employees or newer employees may not like, how do I handle it going forward? So, you know, it's a question of what do employers do when subset doesn't like the political views or opinions of other employees? And two, the bigger question is, going back to what we talked about, you know, in the days where opinions just kind of dissipated, you know, you said something, you know, about my love or distaste for cats over the fence. You know, now when it's recorded and somebody goes, well, you just hired that Scott guy and he doesn't like cats, and I'm a huge cat fan, you got to fire him. Is, you know, what is the tolerance of employees for other employees whose views or politics or religion or statements they don't like? And we've entered kind of a new space where you're seeing more activism. And his case is a good one where people said, these are the sections of his book. We believe they're misogynistic. We believe, you know, some of them may be racist. And so his views do not reflect our D&I at this employer. He shouldn't be here. And you kind of wonder, okay, is that a good standard? Is it a test of people's views? And is that how a place of employment should work? Or should you say, okay, there's a challenge here, and this guy maybe has to prove as he works here, he's not going to treat others in an inappropriate way that violates the terms of employment and the law. I mean, it's a real tough nut, because we're seeing that happen more and more places where, you know, employees or outsiders are saying, are these the views that you, the employer, want? You know, and employers so often result in they just fire people, because then the controversy goes away. And that's not really sustainable.
Hmm. Well, and I also think some of the kinds of I'm not commenting on the merits of his colleagues being upset with what he wrote in this book, Scott, but I think the velocity of these kinds of campaigns is new, and I think that's because of social media. You know, that in the past, if somebody gets hired by a company and people found out he had said some things or written some things they didn't like, I don't know that you could get tens of thousands of people who've never met you online in different states to sign a petition to say that person shouldn't be working there anymore. This is another part of the social media ecosystem that is new, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's one of the benefits and one of the problems. I mean, I think you put your finger on it. I don't think you or I are commenting on the pluses or negatives of his book.
Right, right.
Because, you know, people have really good, valid criticism on both sides. Yet, does it reflect who he is? Does it reflect who he is as an employee? That really never got a chance to be tested because the decision was made so fast, because the signatures were collected so quickly. And that speed is something that's new. And so, you know, maybe 5 years ago, you know, people wouldn't have seen, or not five, but let's say 10 years ago, they wouldn't have seen the book, they wouldn't have had the petitions, and maybe he would have had 6 months. And then people would have said, oh, you know, not so bad. But now, you know, the decision is made super quickly, and the message is spread very quickly. So it's something that's very different. And again, it's also, we talked about it, can be very decontextualizing. You know, we see the letter, we see the media coverage of it, but very few people have probably read the book and went back and looked at it.
That's true, for sure. I'm getting some hilarious emails about F-bombs, but I can't read them on the air. I want listeners to know who are emailing. I want listeners to know I appreciate all of these. I just can't read them. But thank you for that.
Rob thanks you.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I give Rob such a hard time. The guy saves me all the time, you know, really. He's the only reason I'm still on the air. So, Scott, I want to hit some other things before the hour's up here. And one of the strange headlines I saw, the Indiana Senate in March passed a bill that prohibits government employers from microchipping employees. We're not talking about vaccines, and there's no microchips in vaccines, despite what people may have heard in various strange quarters. But just a bill generally saying government employers cannot microchip employees. I did not know this was a concern. But this is not the only state that's apparently tried to address this. What's going on here?
Yeah, so we've seen several states, I think we're at about 10, have passed bills that basically say employers cannot ask employees to put to take microchips. What's the idea? So people have heard of microchipping your dog, okay? So you put your the chip in your dog. It's about the size of a grain of rice. And if your dog gets lost, a reader can read the chip and it'll bring up your information so that, you know, your dog can be reunited with you. So this kind of takes that one step further and says, well, instead of ID badges for employees, instead of keys, we just have these chips. And so now the chip can let somebody into the building, or we can, you know, have a vending machine and people can have an account and utilize the chip. But a number of states have said, no, employers, we're not going to let you use this. This is too much of an invasion of privacy. And again, I think it's probably the visceral nature of it's a physical chip. And so people, we all react a little differently. Whereas a lot of this may have been displaced by biometrics, by, you know, having facial recognition unlock a door, where a lot of people may say, oh, no, that's okay. I know there have been some apartment buildings that have gone to facial recognition and not issuing keys to tenants because it saves a lot of money.
Okay. I guess I am just way behind on the biometrics and biometrics in general. New York has a pending biometrics bill. I'm not even sure I would know how to define this, but what are you following here, Scott? Anything more you want to add here?
So biometrics is just very simply, it's, you know, the things that make you look like you or be you. So it's your fingerprint, mm-hmm. shape of your face. It may be your retina, could be your voice print. And the reason people are concerned is, of course, I can change my password if my password is breached, if my credit card is stolen. We can eminently change those. I can't change my fingerprints. And so, one, you know, the concern is the permanence of it. Two is the fact it kind of creeps in. So you'll see that on a lot of devices, they now let you unlock the device with your face. And so people say, wait a minute, you know, maybe I don't want there to be a database of my comings and goings. So again, take the apartment building with facial recognition letting me in, or an office building. I don't want that record. And third, you wonder, what is being done with that? Is that data being sold? Is that data something that if it's breached, now I as the employee have a problem because there's that perfect map of my face? And there is a pending bill like the Illinois. Illinois' bill is called BIPA, B-I-P-A, and it allows an individual right of action, meaning Evan Dawson can sue if Evan's data is improperly used. New York's allows that, and that has creates a lot of concern for organizations using this kind of data. So we'll see where it goes here in New York. New Yorkers may have an individual right to protect their data.
Yeah, that's kind of what's the biggest legal question that's unanswered here so far with this?
Probably consent. Probably how broad are people's consents? Like you get that new device or you sign up for that new account and you say, you just click OK. And was there a valid and legitimate consent in there? And we'll go back and forth and do a lot of talking about that for a while, probably.
Mm. See, consent comes up, you know, consent is an interesting question. Even before social media, there's different states. I can't remember if New York is a two-party consent state in terms of recording phone conversations. But now people feel like their communications end up recorded and shared in some ways when they didn't know it would be recorded, or they certainly didn't expect it to be shared, and there was all kinds of consent issues there. And I think as a result, some people are trying to reduce their own tech use. And I'm not just talking about trying to do less tech for the sake of it, not using Uber Eats, et cetera, which we can talk about. But I mean, just in general, kind of getting away from whether it's deleting a Facebook account or using less technology to try to communicate. How much do you think people understand just how much of their communication is recorded and could be retrieved, Scott? And how much do they have a right to either know that or to say, hey, I didn't consent that this cannot be shared or used in a certain way?
Right. I think for all of us, we're probably under considering or not as aware as we should be about how much of what we do is being recorded. And the example I'd give is, you know, go to Apple or go to Google or whatever providers you use and request your own data and see how much data comes out. You know, it could be easily 10 gigabytes per a person, you know, and it could be all the searches you've ever made, or it could be your locations. Google, for example, will send you a monthly notice that says, hey, Evan, here are all the places you've been. So it's a lot of data that's being recorded, and it's because, of course, that data is really valuable. If I understand that Joe likes to grab ice cream on Friday nights, you know, after his kids' soccer games, well, then now people who sell ice cream really want that data. And so that's something we all have to understand, particularly when something is free, you know, or a service is free or a device is reduced cost, that data may be collected. And then there's, of course, third-party data, you know, license plate readers as we drive into a mall or a store that's collecting, you know, our location there. And we never even thought about that. So there's a lot more data being collected, and we often have to wonder, how is that going to be used? And is that something we would want? And that's why you're seeing a lot of pushback with laws in California, proposed laws here in New York, laws in Europe about the usage of data. And we're gonna that's gonna be an issue we keep fighting about as a society, because using that data has built our current infrastructure, the current services we have, but it's got a lot of downsides. So
how about turning off Uber Eats and things like that?
Oh yeah. I've definitely myself, just as an observation, I've done that. And a good example with something like Uber Eats is, even if you don't care about the collection of the data, even if you like the convenience, it's, well, is this really working for the restaurant? You know, that's another aspect that we haven't talked about, which is, if there's a business out there that is providing the service, so an Uber or an Uber Eats or someone else, what percentage do they take? If I order a $30 meal from a restaurant and the restaurant's only taking home $10, you know, that's not a really good return for the restaurant. It's not sustainable, and that's not good for the local community. Airbnb has seen a lot of that pushback, too, in smaller vacation communities where people say, you're having investors buy these houses, and they're renting them out continuously, but we don't have kids in the kindergarten. You know, we don't have a person who's there who's maintaining the lawn and building connections with their neighbors. So that's a pushback that we're seeing as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. As social media and technology makes our lives ostensibly easier, what are the unintended consequences? Always good to ask those questions. Let me just read a little bit more listener feedback that I can read on the air. Kate says, Evan, my parents were both teachers and academic administrators. Even light profanity was not heard in our house until I was well into my teens. We were also told that if we got into trouble at school, we were in even more trouble when we got home. Other parents in the district did not share that view, and their kids ran wild. That said, thank God there was no social media back then. I would have destroyed my life many times over between the ages of 22 and 42. Yeah. Kate, thank you for that. I happen to be 42, and it's amazing that I'm still standing. But I appreciate that. Kate, thank you. Another listener, Lynn from Rochester, was talking about people who throw around the F-bomb. Lynn says police have been using that word often when you see tapes of encounters. And Lynn says it's common and it should be stopped. Police officers are professionals. Lynn, I'm just going to say that everybody gets heated. And the question, I think, we can talk about the language and the disrespectful language. I'm not even sure it's just about F-bombs. I think it's just about how we talk to each other and how we communicate. And everybody's got down moments. And the question is, what are the professional standards we expect out of that? And I think questions like that are fair. And then let me get here Leslie, who says, Evan, make sure you point out in the Martinez story from Apple, Martinez has stated that his book was employing a persona. He was writing a certain way to achieve a certain feel. His employers also knew about the book and had talked to him about it. Please tell the other side. Leslie, I appreciate that. As Scott and I said, we're not taking sides on the book itself and the claims about the book. I mean, we understand the criticism. We also understand the defense of it. You are right to point out that Apple did know about this book before they hired him. This book was a New York Times bestseller. Of course they knew about it. So they can't claim, well, we didn't know. You wrote some things that were, we think, are terrible, and if only we had known. They knew. They fired him because of the pressure that was coming from not only colleagues of this guy's at Apple, but on social media. And sometimes that pressure is very strong. Scott?
Yeah, no, I think she raises a good point. I'm glad she wrote in to say that. You know, I kind of wonder whence goes art and literature and things like that.
Sure.
In the sense of, you know, reading his book, he doesn't come across as a person who's really very thoughtful or careful about other people. But maybe that in and of itself is a good service, that it makes you wonder more about, you know, who's building the code and who's building these products we have. And, you know, he said himself, this is a persona. Hulk Hogan maintained in his trial about usage of the kind of scandalous tape that was out there, that Hulk Hogan was a persona that was larger than life. And, you know, the tape didn't really reflect who he was, so it was okay for him to pursue his case. So I think we have to ask that is there going to be a pushback? Are we going to lose art? Are we going to lose other output that maybe is beneficial either because of what it says or because of how we react to it? And so I think she brings up a really good point that we want to be very careful. And again, as we said, there's no hard and fast answer. It's really difficult to do these. But the speed with which we do these things does not support, like, considered reflection, doesn't give us the time to come back.
Yeah, and that's the danger. We're in our last 30 seconds. That's the danger on social is how much speed there is. Even last week in, you know, on the Eastern Seaboard when gas was in short supply and people are sharing videos or pictures of people taking gas in plastic bags and filling up, some of the pictures were from 2 years ago. But but you know how fast people wanted to share them. And it's the speed without verification or the speed of commenting or even joining a call for sanction, someone's firing, etc. It happens fast. And the world has changed in the last decade. So I think there's a lot of value in what Scott brought to us today. And I know there's still a lot of unanswered and unsettled questions, so I know you'll come back and talk to us about it sooner than later, I hope, Scott Maloof.
Anytime. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Scott Maloof is a social media attorney. We always appreciate his expertise and analysis. Rob Braden is the engineer who knows where the dump button is. Didn't use it today. Then again, how would listeners know, Rob? They wouldn't know. Emma Stein, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson saying thank you for listening to your member-supported public radio.